From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we're recapping yesterday's partisan primary election and looking ahead to the midterms. Then, we'll learn about an ongoing project by the Pfister's Artist in Residence, with pieces inspired by the hotel's guests.
People come in and share their stories, and I have a typewriter here so they can write me poems or tell me what's going on in their day that way. I meet all sorts of interesting folks that way, it's true.
Plus, we'll explore the J.R.R. Tolkien collection manuscripts housed at Marquette University.
What one can do, literally, is trace his creative process through the manuscripts. He was one of these people who did not plan out a story in great detail at the start. He just sort of started writing, and the stories grew in the telling.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Wisconsin's primary results are in, and the state is one step closer to determining who it's choosing in the 2022 midterms. Yesterday, voters headed to the polls to decide who will represent each party in the upcoming midterm election. On the ballot, we have candidates for Wisconsin governor, lieutenant governor, U.S. senator, attorney general, secretary of state, state treasurer, some state legislators, and of course, many more races. Joining us to talk about the results is WUWM's Mayon Silver. Hello, Mayon. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
So, Mayon, what were the main takeaways from this primary election last night?
Okay, so here's the cliff notes. Number one, it was a mixed bag for Trump-endorsed candidates. In a pretty big upset, Trump-backed construction businessman Tim Michaels beat out establishment Republican Rebecca Clayfish in the GOP primary for governor. But at the same time, GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was able to edge out his Trump-endorsed challenger, Adam Steen. So the second point, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes coasted to victory in the Democratic U.S. Senate primary as expected. And number three, Milwaukee has a new sheriff-elect.
So, of course, there is a lot to unpack there. We'll get into more about all of it in just a bit here. But first, can you tell us about that Wisconsin governor's race? Republican Tim Michaels won the candidacy by a pretty small margin, but still a margin of victory. How did that happen, and what does it mean?
It was neck and neck for weeks between Clayfish and Michaels, but around 10:15, 10:30 last night, Michaels was able to declare victory. He jumped into the race pretty late in April, but was able to pour millions of his own money into the campaign. He came out on top despite some pretty relentless Clayfish attack ads throughout the summer, and he portrayed himself as a government outsider, just how Trump said he was, and how Trump said he'd drain the swamp. Michaels promised that he'd, quote, turn Madison upside down. That's even though Michaels has been politically minded for a while, having lost races for both state Senate and U.S. Senate. It's now Michaels versus Evers as the incumbent.
I was about to say, this is not Michaels' first race, but it is going to be a big one for him. Now, what can you tell us about the Voss-Steen race, which has become pretty heated?
Yes, Steen is a far-right Republican who campaigned on a platform of overturning the 2020 election results and who actually wanted to ban birth control beyond Plan B. ABC 27 in Madison reported that they asked Steen, birth control ahead of time, would that be outlawed? And Steen answered, right, because you're simply trying to avoid a consequence. So Trump endorsed Steen as part of his war path, really, against Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He was calling Voss a rhino, Republican in name only, because Voss didn't agree that Trump won Wisconsin in 2020 and allegedly hasn't done enough to overturn the results. That's even though Voss hired a former, a conservative former state Supreme Court justice to investigate the election, which did not uncover any other incidences of fraud. Voss was able to beat back the challenge, calling Gableman an embarrassment for his attack ads for Steen against Voss. So, yeah, it got messy.
Yeah, pretty messy there. Just to clarify, Gableman is, of course, the former state Supreme Court who has been, quote, investigating what happened during the 2020 election. What do these two races specifically say about the current state of Wisconsin politics on the Republican side?
So Clayfish served as lieutenant governor under Scott Walker, and she was aligned with the Walker era of Wisconsin politics. In some ways, that particular governor's race was looked at as a test of the Republican electorate in Wisconsin in 2022, whether it's, you know, more in line with Trump's more rural coalition or whether there's still a strong traditional suburban GOP base. For instance, in the WOW counties of Washington, Ozaukee, and Waukesha, where Walker has traditionally been supported. If you look at the maps of the Michaels and Clayfish election, you saw support of a similar Trump-style county-by-county results for Michaels. Lots of support in the northern part of the state. Frankly, he won everywhere except for a strip between Milwaukee and Madison in the WOW counties, Walworth and Brown, and a bit in the center of the state. So, you know, that was pretty interesting. Also, Voss was able to fend off Steen, but fairly narrowly for someone who has wielded such control over the legislature for nearly 10 years. Voss won by less than 3 percentage points.
It was a very close race in part of the state where, yes, as you say, he has been a politician for quite a long time. He has a big base there. Now, turning to the U.S. Senate primary for the Democrats, with several candidates dropping out just before this election, we sort of knew that Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes would be taking on Senator Ron Johnson in November. What's important about this race?
Well, Democrats so narrowly control the U.S. Senate. It's 50-50 with a tiebreaker to Vice President Kamala Harris. So this general election face-off between Johnson and Barnes is one of the key races that could decide control of the Senate for the next 2 years. That's because Johnson is seen as one of the most vulnerable Republican U.S. senators seeking re-election this year. One indicator is the June Marquette Law School poll. It showed 46% of Wisconsin voters had an unfavorable view of him, with only 37% with a favorable one.
How would you characterize Johnson and Barnes' different approaches to politics? These are very different politicians. And what are the parties saying about their candidates?
Johnson is closely aligned with MAGA and Trump. He's known for peddling COVID and other misinformation, but he's tried to make his ads about the Joseph Project, which is a campaign that connects underserved individuals to manufacturing jobs, and his conservative views on inflation and public safety. Meanwhile, Barnes is a progressive. He has a working class background and experience as a community organizer. He's supportive of the Green New Deal and investing in communities, reducing police budgets, but not defunding the police. So the race just provides a very stark contrast for voters. The Wisconsin GOP has called Barnes a fringe left candidate and says it's laughable that he, quote, thinks he'll convince people that he's a moderate. Wisconsin Democrats say that Johnson has lost touch with what people in Wisconsin need during his time in office, and they say he's pushing an agenda that benefits him and his special interest donors.
All right, so looking at this partisan primary, there were quite a number of races on the ballot. Were there any other nationally important races in Wisconsin that had primaries last night?
Of Wisconsin's 8 congressional districts, only one is competitive. That's in the 3rd district, which covers most of the Driftless area in southwestern and western Wisconsin. That includes Eau Claire, La Crosse, Stevens Point. Democrat Ron Kind has served in that office for 26 years but is not seeking re-election. He's been under consistent attack from Republicans who want to flip the seat. Republican Derek Van Orden is a retired Navy SEAL who's supported by Trump. He ran in the GOP primary uncontested, and Van Orden attended Trump's rally ahead of the January 6th insurrection. Brad Paff, on the other hand, won the Democratic primary last night to go against Van Orden and try to fill Kind's shoes.
All right. What about the results of other important statewide races? There's the attorney general race and lieutenant governor.
So incumbent Democratic attorney general Josh Call had an unopposed primary. He'll be up against It looks like Fond du Lac Republican prosecutor Eric Toney, he was going up against former state representative Adam Jarko. Jarko issued an apparent concession early this morning, urging his supporters to unite behind Toney. That race was too close for the Associated Press to declare an official winner. The unofficial results showed him trailing Toney by less than 1% of the vote. Karen Miller, who ran as an outsider who wants to decertify the 2020 presidential results, received nearly 26% of the vote. And in the lieutenant governor race, there were both Republican and Democratic primaries since Mandela Barnes is running for U.S. Senate. So Sarah Rodriguez won the Democratic primary. She's a registered nurse and state representative from the Tulsa-Brookfield area. She'll be on the ticket with Evers, and Roger Roth, a state senator from Appleton, will be on the ballot with GOP candidate for governor Tim Michaels.
What about the Secretary of State position?
The Secretary of State race is usually a pretty sleepy race in Wisconsin. The same man, Doug La Follette, has held the office for 44 out of the past 48 years, and he won last night's primary, but he's challenged by a Republican state representative now, Amy Loudenbeck, who's, you know, pretty much outraising him pretty significantly, according to the Journal Sentinel. Some Wisconsin Republicans, including, you know, Michaels, the gubernatorial candidate, want to dissolve the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission. So while Michaels has been short on specifics as to who he wants to control those duties, other Republicans have floated the option of giving control over elections to the partisan Secretary of State's office. J.R. Ross of WisPolitics has said that key Republicans like Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu are still in favor of maintaining the Wisconsin Elections Commission.
All right, so turning from state to local offices, Milwaukee County actually picked its next sheriff last night. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Sheriff Ernell Lucas ran for Milwaukee mayor and lost in the February primary. After that, he announced he wouldn't be trying to get reelected as sheriff, so his chief deputy, Dr. Danita Ball, ran in the Democratic primary last night and won. Since there was no Republican primary, Ball will be the next Milwaukee County sheriff. She'll be the first woman to serve in that role, and she'll have to tackle tough issues like a spike in homicides in the city of Milwaukee and staffing shortages and other difficulties at the Milwaukee County Jail.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us here this morning. That is WUWM's Mayon Silver joining us with the primary results in Wisconsin. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joy.
At WUWM.com, you can find more of our coverage of the midterm elections. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Guests at the Pfister serve as viewers and participants in an ongoing project by the hotel's current artist-in-residence. Coming up, we'll learn more about his work. But first, we'll tell you how you can be part of a plan to make Milwaukee a more environmentally conscious city. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. For the last 3 years, a task force composed of citizens, advocacy groups, and city and county officials have been creating Milwaukee's Climate and Equity Plan. The task force is working toward its adoption by both the City of Milwaukee and the county governments by the beginning of 2023. Supporters say broad citizen involvement will be critical to making what's laid out in the plan become a reality. And a proposed coalition called Our Future Milwaukee could help. Task Force member Linda Frank joins WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz to explain more. Frank starts with her own involvement as a volunteer.
I got myself engaged with it from the beginning, went to every meeting. I was very committed to it. And there was an opening that came up when the person delegated by the Sierra Club moved out of town, and the local Sierra Club group then nominated me to take her place. So I've been a task force member and a chair of a couple of the work groups.
You're at a critical point in the process, wouldn't you say?
Yes, we are. There's a consultant called Grafe. They have taken all of the proposals that were developed by the task force. They are putting that together into a draft climate and equity plan for Milwaukee. That is going to come out later this summer or fall, and then it will be open for public viewing and comment.
At the same time, there's an effort that we're talking about today to form a coalition. Explain the idea and why it's felt by advocates to be necessary.
We are just starting the process of forming a coalition. It's called Our Future Milwaukee. It's being launched by the Education and Outreach Work Group of the Task Force. And this coalition will bring, there are so many organizations that have been working on climate and equity issues. We'd like to get many of them involved, as well as individuals who are committed to climate and equity action and environmental justice. So we need to have this coalition because the plan is going to come out. The coalition will advocate for adoption of the plan and, very importantly, advocate for this to be a priority, that all of the programs become a reality. It's going to take a strong community voice to make that happen, to let our elected leaders know that this needs to be a priority and that funding and resources need to be committed to it. So we are just launching that coalition, Our Future Milwaukee, and the first information sessions are coming up this month.
So would this be a 501c3?
I'd say it's early days to talk about that, and really, we are not, as the work group, we are not gonna control the coalition. And so this forming of the coalition and direction of the coalition is going to be created by the people who come together and take part in it.
When did the idea come about that a coalition was a necessary tool?
This coalition is part of the recommendation that came from the Education Outreach Work Group, knowing that all of these work groups and the task force itself have a definite timeline. We're going to complete our task, but the job of addressing climate change is not going to be done when the climate and equity plan gets passed. So we're looking at meeting those targets for 2030 and for 2050 and continuing the process and improving upon that. So we proposed a coalition of community groups and individuals to monitor that and advocate for it and make it happen.
At these hour-long sessions, what will the focus be? To talk about what you've told me or to go through the individual recommendations of the task force or all of those things?
Most importantly, the topic for the one-hour session will be to go over the role and the importance of the coalition.
Like you said, the direction it takes, you can't predict that for sure, but do you envision coalition representatives attending all of the meetings that of both the task force and anything going on at the city and county level they feel should be addressing a component of the climate action plan?
I envision the coalition members meeting with each other and disseminating the information developed by the coalition to reach out to their constituents to say, you know, this is the time to contact your local alderperson, your county supervisor, and ask for their support. So there will be updates that will go out to the constituents of the coalition members and call to action.
Do you feel that there are a lot of people in the community, in the region, who know little or nothing about the task force or the proposals they're making? What's your sense?
I think you're right in suspecting that. And yes, we need to get the word out, and I think that the coalition coming together could be a big part of that. Getting the word out, that is really a critical piece.
So you, as a citizen, put a lot of time and energy into this. Why?
I'm very committed to being engaged in what I feel will make things better. And for me, addressing climate, addressing the biodiversity crisis, and restoring nature is what I'm committed to. And so that's what I do with my life now.
Is there something that you want people to know, you know, right now, who again may fall into that, I've sort of heard about this, not, I don't mean climate change, but about the effort afoot, that you want listeners to be aware of as they consider tuning in into one of these sessions?
This is what I'd have to say. People are aware of climate change. People understand that climate change is happening, and they probably realize they are experiencing some effects of climate change because it is happening right now. I think what might be missing is people knowing that there's something that can be done. And that is what the Climate and Equity Plan offers. And that's why people may want to get connected to that, know what's going on with the plan, know what the programs are, and maybe be part of the coalition so that they can be part of knowing that they're doing something about climate change.
Linda Frank is an environmental lawyer and an active member of the Milwaukee City County Task Force on Climate and Economic Equity. The Our Future Milwaukee Coalition will be holding information sessions, and you can find out more about them at wuwm.com. Metaphysics has been described as the science of imaginary solutions, but it's also the foundation of a body of work on display at the Pfister Hotel by Milwaukee-based artist Christopher Wood, the hotel's current artist-in-residence. The pieces in his day drawing project combine water and graphite with artwork inspired by stories and experiences with guests at the Pfister. As the artist-in-residence, Wood has a studio on the first floor of the hotel. Its walls are filled with works from the project. I joined him there to learn more. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us. What does it mean to be the artist-in-residence here at the Pfister?
I have my studio at the Pfister Hotel for a period of 1 year. And contrary to what some people think when they pass through here, I do not live here. I just work here. So I produce my work here and exhibit it in the same space.
The Pfister itself is a really interesting hotel. It's a historic hotel. But beyond that, there are so many different people who pass through here. I've certainly been here when there are basketball teams. You'll have politicians who are coming through, and the variety of people who end up visiting Milwaukee. Meanwhile, you're really right in the center of it. What is it like being in this space, which is both quintessentially Milwaukee, but also has this group of people who are experiencing the city, often for the first time?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot there that you're talking about that I experience here. So, yeah, there's the people who have stayed and who come in, or like think all of the presidents, at least almost all of the presidents have stayed here. And yeah, musicians and sports teams. And it's so cool to just be in contact with all of these well-known people. But it's also, like you said, it's Milwaukee. It's very Milwaukee. So it's warm and inviting. And I feel like I can have a conversation with anybody who comes in the room and doesn't feel stuffy or, I mean, that's kind of the spirit of the Pfister too. It's that spirit of hospitality.
Do you have a lot of people who are coming in and engaging with you?
Oh, sure. Plenty of people. Yeah. And that's part of what I'm doing here. I think that's part of the reason for the artist to be here in the hotel. And it's also part of my mission personally being here. So the hotel wants people to come in and interact with the artist about the existing collection, as well as about the artwork that I'm doing in the studio. And so my own project is intended for people to be here and engaging with it, right? So this daily drawing project that I'm doing is taking the stories of people who are passing through the hotel and working those into the drawings. So yeah, lots of people come in and interact, and I welcome that. And people come in and share their stories. And I have a typewriter here so they can write me poems or tell me what's going on in their day that way. And I meet all sorts of interesting folks that way. It's true.
So right now, as we're speaking, we're in a room that is surrounded by your work. Are these pieces that are from your current project, or are these other works that you are exhibiting here?
Most of them at this point are from the current project. So the work on this side of the room is from before the residency. And as I'm here, I am taking this down, and the project, the daily drawing projects I'm doing here, are taking over the room. So I can fit 3 months of drawings on this long wall. And on this short wall, I'm going to be replacing the old stuff with highlights from the previous months as we move through the course of the year.
What is the medium here? Because I'm seeing that it's paper. Are you using ink or paint, or?
This is all powdered graphite on paper. I have many different processes for applying it. So you see a lot of different techniques, but yeah, it's all powdered graphite.
It is interesting. They all change a lot. Look at these pieces, especially since so many of them now are based on stories. Do you think about the people who inspired them? What are some that stick out to you?
Yeah, each one has its own story, right? So they're not so much individuals, and it's really more about the continuation of the story through the whole piece. So each one has its own contained story, but it's also interconnected to all the other pieces in some different ways. So like there's the technical stuff, like how they're visually cohesive, but then the story of one day kind of bleeds into the story of the next as I borrow forms and kind of combine them with forms from a different story, a different person's story, or something that was happening in the hotel, or just the remnants of some conversation I had with a visitor. So it's not even necessarily an illustration of somebody's entire story. Sometimes it's just an abstraction of the feeling that was left after the person left the room. And then the next day, that feeling bleeds into, you know, the moon that I had been talking about with somebody. And then the mushroom comes in the next day, which was left on a note on my door by somebody, and so forth.
I can see the mushrooms. There's a few different mushrooms, and I see what you mean by the moon. There's a few over there. I'm also seeing a lot of legs. Is there a reason for the legs? You don't have to get into it if you don't want to.
Yeah, there was a story. I got a note somebody had left me that inspired the first leg, which I won't go into, but yeah, it did spur the other legs. You know, one of them is, there's a lot of meaning in them, yeah, but they are inspired by a note that I was left.
So overall, as you look at the pieces you're creating, what would you say is the story you feel you're telling?
The most important thing here to me about this project is that it exists in an infinite number of small pieces, right? So these pieces, they are spreading around the world, and they are all various pieces of this single object. So I want people to be able to have a piece of it and feel connected to everyone else who has a piece, or everywhere else the project exists. So it's a way of connecting people who don't normally have any connection to one another. Yeah, it's building a bridge, or you might say like it's a nexus that is connecting all different people from different places. This project can be of an infinite size because the pieces will keep being added to it every day forever. So, and pataphysicians don't die so much as make the gesture of dying. So as the project will proliferate forever, so that it becomes this enormous hyper object that can continue expanding beyond the scope of the traditional human time and space scale that we're able to perceive through our senses.
I think I get the edges of what you're saying. So is it, when you think about your art, is the concept that these are pieces of a whole that exist beyond our perception? Does that seem right?
Yes. So when you experience this project, you can experience a piece of it, or you might say it's an instance of the project, and that kind of plugs you into the entirety, which is beyond what you can experience directly.
All right. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for coming in. It's been lovely talking to you.
Christopher Wood is a Milwaukee-based visual artist and the current artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel. At WUWM.com, you can see photos of his work and his studio, as well as a link to his profile in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn about the J.R.R. Tolkien collections at Marquette University. But first, we'll hear from the owner of WellSpace MKE about how she wants to make mental health and wellness accessible for both clients and professionals.
So I hope with WellSpace MKE, we are able to take mental health and wellness by storm, get more people access to different services that they maybe would have never thought about even looking into if it wasn't under one roof.
That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Late last year, Esperanza Winter opened WellSpace MKE on the west side of Milwaukee. It's a co-working collective space for mental health and wellness providers who may be starting out and need a physical space, but aren't ready to sign a lease. Winters is also the owner and therapist at The Practice MKE. She joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to talk about WellSpace MKE.
WellSpace is a wellness collective for mental health and wellness practitioners, which can be other therapists, massage, acupuncturists, people that do coaching, Reiki, and a smorgasbord of other services. We're new. We just opened in October of 2021. So a lot of my colleagues over the quarantine let go of their office spaces and went to virtual practices just because it was too much to keep up with rent when no one was coming in person. And so I had an opportunity to move my practice from Shorewood to the other side of Milwaukee. And I'm like, okay, so Esperanza, how can you make this work for yourself and other people to be able to benefit as well? So I had an idea like, well, I can get this space and then share the space for collaboration purposes with other practitioners. Not only does it help me to not be in a solo practice, but it offers members of the community access to different types of wellness services all under one roof.
Tell me a little bit about the layout of the space. Are there any other similar spaces in the Milwaukee area at all?
We have two rooms that are dedicated to psychotherapy, coaching, any one-on-one service. And then we have the body space room that's geared towards body work. So individual yoga, Reiki, acupuncture, massage. Our space is located right in the heart of Milwaukee on the west side. We are on a bus line right off 92nd and Center. I think that's important. Our building is ADA compliant. So if you would happen to need to access an elevator, we have that available as well. So to my knowledge, there are a few different wellness collectives that offer a variety of services. One of the beautiful things about WellSpace is the space in itself is, I'll say, like high class. It's a really nice space. Typically when people walk in, they're often shocked at how nice it is. That I've gotten comments where people have said, like, I've never been in a professional office that looks as nice and welcoming as WellSpace. Another perk for the individual providers are they're still able to maintain their own business. So WellSpace isn't an employer. We just provide the space for people to meet with clients.
And it also sounds like it's for other wellness professionals to meet with each other too. What has that been like to own and operate your own practice on top of also working with other wellness professionals in WellSpace, MKEU?
It's actually really cool because, you know, sometimes the client may be able to benefit from a different type of service that could work in conjunction with the service that you're providing, and being able to say like, hey, you're interested in Reiki. We have a person here. Here's this person's card and contact information, and you can come here and get the services you want as well. And then in addition, being able to have other people to bounce ideas off of, whether it's social media, whether it's case consultation. Just recently, we had an open house and where all the providers themselves got the chance to meet. We plan to offer more networking opportunities in the future for community members that are within the profession, as well as services, service-driven networking events for community participants. So it's really nice to not have to work as an individual and be isolated and to be able to just bump into someone in the space.
Throughout the pandemic, mental health and taking care of your mental health has been really top of mind. And the vast majority of mental health professionals are white women. And I would say that just like personally, finding a mental health professional who is also Asian American, who is also a woman of color, is hard within my insurance coverage or just generally going through other directories. And as a mental health professional, from your perspective, you have created the space, WellSpace MKE, you talked a little bit about this. Clients who come in are like, wow, this is so comfortable. This is so beautiful. So as a mental health professional, what is the importance of being able and creating a physical space that both supports health and wellness professionals and also creating a space that is comfortable for clients?
It was very important to me because so often when getting started, you might have questions and just have no one to be able to ask or bounce ideas off. It's also nice to be in a space that is diverse, right? And so we have psychotherapists of multi-races. Our Reiki person is African-American. Our acupuncturist is Latina. And so we offer a variety of different services from a variety of different people, and we would like to have even more just to be able to serve all demographics. We don't want it to be, you know, just a space where only one particular type of person can come, but for all people of the community to be able to access the services we have, because mental health and wellness services are really important.
With the pandemic, it's really pushed us to rethink about what our city's future could look like. Through WellSpace MKE, what are you hoping to reimagine in Milwaukee with this space?
I'm just hoping to be able to provide providers or practitioners with a space to give them a boost, to get off of the ground, to be able to access a space that looks nice and that's affordable while they build their practices. And then if they need to move on, they move on. For community members, just being able to access a variety of services all under one roof, I feel like is really important. Being able to have a provider that can refer out to someone that is close and they have a personal relationship with is very important as well. And so I hope with WellSpace MKE, we are able to take mental health and wellness by storm, get more people access to different services that they maybe would have never thought about even looking into if it wasn't under one roof.
Esperanza Winters is the owner of WellSpace MKE. She's also the owner and therapist at the practice MKE. Winters spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in April. J.R.R. Tolkien was an English writer and teacher, but he's best known as the author of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. These books have impacted generations of readers. But Tolkien fans may be surprised to know that a bit of his history lives right here in Milwaukee. Marquette University is home to an archive that includes books by and about Tolkien, periodicals, audio and video recordings. Marquette is partnering up with the Hagerty Museum of Art for an upcoming exhibition. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke to Marquette archivist William Fliss about the collection last year.
So how did the J.R.R. Tolkien collection end up at Marquette University?
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing that this collection is here because the author J.R.R. Tolkien was not an American. He was English. He never set foot in the United States in his lifetime. And so we have the manuscripts for, I think, his most famous fictional works, especially The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings here at Marquette. And it's surprising that they're here in Milwaukee of all places, but it's really because of the vision of a man named William Reedy, who Marquette hired in 1956 to be director of the brand new library that it had just built. And Reedy's job was to stock this new library with books and manuscripts. And he had a reputation as a manuscript hunter, and he identified Tolkien as somebody whose manuscripts he wanted to acquire. And so he reached out to him through a friend of his that he hired to be Marquette's agent. And this was at the end of 1956, and which was actually wasn't long after the publication of The Lord of the Rings. So this was a period before Tolkien became wildly popular as an author. And Reedy was really in the right place at the right time. He was the first to ask. And so he asked Professor Tolkien if he would consider selling his manuscripts to Marquette. And Tolkien agreed. And so the deal was struck in 1957. And so the manuscripts have been here now for over 60 years.
That's pretty incredible that he had this foresight to know that these works would be of great value and, of course, still hold massive legs today and countless numbers of fans and new generations of fans even. And so you mentioned the manuscripts. What other things are within this collection?
Well, the manuscripts are the heart of the collection. Those are the actual original papers that he wrote the story out on, all the different drafts, handwritten, typescripts, notes, the galley sheets, page proofs, almost everything from conception, for The Lord of the Rings especially, everything from the original concept through to publication is here at Marquette. That was really the heart of the collection. And then over the years, Marquette expanded its collection. It began to acquire the secondary works that were coming out about Tolkien's writings. And then also, we began to document the fandom that grew up around his creative writing, which really began in maybe in the late 50s, early 60s, and it continued to grow. And so we've documented that over the years in a variety of different ways.
And on the note of fandoms, can you tell us a bit about the J.R.R. Tolkien Fandom Oral History Collection?
Certainly. At this, the Fandom Oral History Collection is something that we just started a couple of years ago. And it was an idea I had to try to document contemporary fandom. The early Tolkien fandom was fairly easy to document because it was so heavily tied up into the fan magazines that would circulate throughout the country, the fanzines. And we have, thanks to some collectors out there, we have an amazing collection of fanzines here at Marquette. But I wanted to find a way to document contemporary fandom, the fandom today around Tolkien. And we could do this in some cases by capturing and harvesting websites, because so much of the fandom has moved online. But I was trying to think of other ways to collect the fandom. And so I came upon this idea of trying to gather brief I call them interviews, but they're really more like testimonials from fans where they have a chance to talk about when they first encountered his works, why they're a fan of his works, and what, if anything, he's meant to them in their lives. And basically, each fan has up to 3 minutes to share what they would like. And so I capture these as audio interviews, and then I make a transcript, and then I publish these online for people to interact with, to listen to read the transcripts, to search across the transcripts. And it's been a wonderful collection, just fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
And I'd like to ask you one of those prompts, which is, what was your first experience with the works of J.R.R. Tolkien?
Well, I'm of an age, I've noticed this in the interviews, where if you get... people of a certain age, their first entry into Tolkien seems to have been the 1977 animated Rankin-Bass television production of The Hobbit. It's amazing how often that shows up in interviews. And that was actually my first introduction to Tolkien as well.
Yeah, similarly, I read The Hobbit in middle school and also watched that movie. That was the first time I was exposed. And with this collection, of course, with the original manuscripts and those fantastic works, you know, how do these documents give us a window into Tolkien's creative process? You know, one thing I imagine are like initial sketches and how exciting it must be to see the original idea compared to the final fleshed out maps and projects of all the places he created in his stories.
Absolutely. And that's one of the amazing things about this collection is that it is so comprehensive. It's rare to find a collection as comprehensive as this one. For The Lord of the Rings especially, with the exception of some items that are over at the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford, where Tolkien taught, with the exception of some manuscripts that are over there, we have pretty much everything that went into the writing of the book that has survived. Although we don't really have many of the formal maps that he did for his secondary world. And so what one can do literally is trace his creative process through the manuscripts. He was one of these people who did not plan out a story in great detail at the start. He just sort of started writing, and the stories grew in the telling. And so you can see his stops and starts along the way. And because writing and thinking were very closely connected for him, he would think by writing something out. And so he would occasionally jot plot notes or thoughts about the story. And through those, you could actually see some of the ideas in the tale taking shape in his mind over time. And with other context clues, we can date some of the manuscripts. So we have sort of a rough timeline on how The Lord of the Rings in particular came into being.
Is there one part of the collection that you're particularly drawn to or is a favorite?
It changes a little bit from time to time as I discover new things. I do really do like the plot notes. I like some of the just little notes he would do. There's one particular page I love with him doodling while he's on vacation in late summer 1938 with his family. They were on vacation in Devonshire, and he was... working on The Lord of the Rings. And so you see some doodles on the page, but at the same time, there are also notations about the story where he's thinking through the plot and what's going to happen in the story. And that's one of my favorites.
So obviously he's had a massive impact on pop culture, on literature, many aspects of our lives. How do you think Tolkien has shaped people's worldview?
The interviews I've been doing provide a window into that. It's amazing how deeply Tolkien has affected some people. A lot of people are fans for a variety of different reasons, but he connects to people on a very deep emotional level. There are a lot of reasons people are drawn to him. I think a lot of the within the story, there are strong moral values that come through that are, I think, timeless. I don't think in some ways it doesn't matter what culture you come from or what your religious tradition might be, but there are things like love, friendship, loyalty, courage, perseverance, self-sacrifice. These sort of values and virtues come through in the story, and people are really drawn to that. One of the things that I've been doing with the oral history collection is taking all of the interviews, the transcripts from them, and putting them into a data set that can be analyzed. And I haven't really analyzed them yet. I'm putting it out there for the public to analyze as they wish. But one of the things I'd be interested to see is what the most common words are that are used in these interviews. And I would guess, just anecdotally, impressionistically, based on having listened to you know, over 500 of these, probably the word hope. He really, there's something about his stories that gives people hope. And I think that certainly in this past year, a lot of the interviews that I have been listening to, his ability to provide hope has been important for people going through this pandemic.
William Fliss is an archivist in the Department of Special Collections in University Archives at Marquette University. Next Friday, the Haggerty Museum of Art will open an exhibition featuring manuscripts and other items from the J.R.R. Tolkien collection, many of which have not been previously displayed or published. That starts next Friday, August 19th. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for being here with us. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about monkeypox, how it's transmitted, and what you can do to protect yourself. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.